Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. In the last podcast, we were doing a reading and commentary from Lao Tzu's writings. So we're going to do part two today. So Pete's going to read out the second and third pages, and then we're going to have a little bit of a chat about it and see what we think. As you can tell, the birds are very excited all around us today. So I hope you're not being deafened if you're listening to this with headphones on.
Okie dokie. Last time we discussed chapter one of the Tao Te Ching.
Yeah.
Of Lao Tzu. It was writing some centuries before the Common Era. Today I'm going to look at chapters two and three. I'm putting those two together because they deal with a single theme.
They're quite similar in what they discuss, aren't they?
It's the theme of opposites.
Yeah.
Okay, chapter two. Beauty and mercy are only recognised by people because they know the opposite, which is ugly and mean. If the people think they know goodness, then all they really know is what evil is like. Nothing and heaven share the same root. Difficulty and ease are a part of all work. The long and the short are in your hands. Above and below exist because they each do. What you want and what you say should be the same. Neither future nor past can exist alone. The sage has no attachment to anything. He therefore does what is right without speaking, by simply being in the Tao.
And that translation is from...
That's the same translation that we used before. It's by Manho Kwok, Martin Palmer and Jay Ramsey working together on that. And chapter three, I think we can carry on with that. If the sage refuses to be proud, then people won't compete for his attention. If the sage does not buy treasures, then the people won't want to steal them. If the sage governs with vision, then his people will not go wrong. So, in his wisdom, he restrains himself by not being greedy for food, by not dominating the state, by keeping himself healthy and fit. The sage always makes sure that the people don't know what he's done, so they never want to be in control, and they are never driven by ambition. He keeps them in the truth like this, acting invisibly. You see, if there is nothing to fight for, then there is nothing that can break the flow.
I like that translation better than the other one that I looked at this morning. This makes more sense to me.
Okay. we have got another translation with us. We've been comparing, and they are considerably different.
It's surprising.
Yeah, we have the problem of translation. Well, with any translation, you know, and there are big philosophical issues around what happens when you translate. And if you've listened to me speaking about the Yoga Sutra, this is something I kind of harp on about, you know. And comparing translations is very useful, as is getting into the root meaning of words. Now, I've got a lot less skill in ancient Mandarin than I have in Sanskrit, and a lot less skill in
Welsh.
A lot less skill in Sanskrit than I got in English, you know. So I do rely on the scholarship of translators, but as I say, they're quite different.
Okay, so tell us what you think about the first reading then. Beauty and mercy are only recognised by people because they know the opposite, which is ugly and mean. Yeah. As it begins.
This is the whole linchpin of the Taoist understanding of the world, and we did mention this in the first podcast, because Lao Tzu mentioned it in his very opening to the Tao Te Ching, and that's this idea of the mutual dependence of opposites. As I mentioned before, this is an ancient idea that's found in all parts of the world. It's archetypal idea. There must be something about human thinking and human pondering and human contemplation that draws us in the direction of opposites, draws us towards this idea. But in chapter two, Lao Tzu discussing opposites, at least part of the time, in a less cosmic fashion. Certainly in this first verse here, beauty and mercy are only recognised by people because they know the opposite, which is ugly and mean. And this is about the way language and concepts work for people. And Lao Tzu's happening on an insight that we might have had to wait for the 20th century to occur in Europe with the Saussurean linguistics. And it's the observation is that that language and the way language facilitates human understanding is contrastive. It works through contrasts. You know, as he said, if you had hot without cold, you couldn't appreciate what cold was. Or if you have beauty without ugliness, you have no means of appreciating it. And it's actually difference and contrast that Lao Tzu is drawing our attention to here. Inbuilt in language is the way language actually works, that in turn structures our understanding. Now Lao Tzu, of course, he's urging us through contemplation to bring the opposites into the mystical union, you know, to go from yin and yang, male female, light dark, night day, to the Tao in which all opposites are contained, and in fact in some kind of ecstatic embrace, which in turn is productive of the universe, the 10,000 things. So in a sense, he's pointing out how we understand and therefore negotiate the world through conceptual and perceptual contrasts, which come down to dualities, you know, binary opposites. But he's also urging us to go a bit, you know, a bit deeper, you might say, you know, not to lay the spade down with that, as far as our understanding goes. He wants us to attempt to deepen our understanding by getting to the place where the opposites are not so opposite and are actually mutually dependent. And of course, as you mentioned, the great Tai Chi diagram, in which you've got a circle divided into two by a wavy line. And there's a white half and a black half, but the black half contains a small white circle, and the white half contains a small black circle as a seed. That will grow, so that, you know, that white slowly turns to black, and black turns to white, and yin turns to yang, and yang turns to yin, and day turns to night, and night turns to day. So he's wanting us to see, first of all, that the opposites are not fixed, but a process. He's wanting us to see that they provide the contrasts by which we are able to build our human understanding, but at the same time he's telling us they are ultimately one, and asking us to move towards that great ultimate, you know. And then he goes on, he talks about the opposites of beauty and ugly, and mercifulness and meanness. Well, first of all, beauty and ugly are qualities of the world. They're aesthetic qualities that we apprehend in the world. And he's saying, well, that, you know, we apprehend those through their ability to contrast with each other, and that builds our understanding. But he's also talking about mercy and meanness. Now, these are qualities of people as well. But again, we only recognise them in other people through contrast. We only recognise generous people because we know mean people. And we only recognise mean people because we know generous people. I mean, he goes on to say, if the people think they know goodness, all they really know is what evil is like. Well, it's a little bit rhetorical. It's a little bit rhetorical there, but, you know, good and evil. Yeah, great opposites. Yeah. Perhaps in terms of the understanding of human conduct and human attitudes and human character, they are very primordial. You know, just good and evil. Really right down there in the root of our the way in which we negotiate the world through our understanding and through the language that we have. That's how primordial that Friedrich Nietzsche wrote a book called Beyond Good and Evil, you know, which is one of his 1888 books, and it's a pretty great work. But he was alert to something like what Lao Tzu is saying here. He was alert to that, you know, to that contrastive nature of language. Anyway, Lao Tzu goes on and he says, nothing and heaven share the same root. Difficulty and ease are all part of the work. So he's noting, I mean, by nothing and heaven there, he means, by heaven he means it's like an all-inclusive idea he's wanting. He's wanting there, you know, the whole. So this fullness of the whole of everything is related through the ultimate conjunction of opposites to nothingness, you know, everythingness and nothingness, and this is again the story of the plain and void, which he introduced in the very first chapter again, you know, the fertility of nothingness.
It's just meant, just tell us what the plain and void is, just give us a bit. On that.
Well, it's the idea that the void is never completely void. It's always pregnant. You know, this is a paradoxical. The plain and void means the full emptiness. You know, as I say, these ideas are very primordial, and they occur in many parts of the world and in many eras and many epochs. And this is what Lao Tzu is pointing to. With, you know, nothing and heaven share the same root. Well, the Tao. That which is behind everything and behind even that and behind and behind and behind.
Yeah, I love that line. It's really good.
Such that it contains both everything and completely nothing. It's completely empty yet completely full of everything, and passive yet infinitely productive, and in fact productive of the universe and its creatures, including us. The long and the short are in your hands. Above and below exist because they each do. Again, you know, the contrastive nature of these concepts is what enables them to work for us in our practical understanding. But at some level they are dependent on each other. At some level they are in a mystical union, in the unio mystica, you know, as we say in Western Hermeticism. And we've got the same thing here. Neither future nor past can exist alone. I mean, this is a very, very interesting take on time. I mean, we hear a lot these days about being in the moment, you know. But actually, an infinitesimal moment, say, I don't know, 10 to the minus 9 of a second, if you like, would actually be incomprehensible to us if you were truly in the moment, because the next one would be fractured from it. And it's through kind of continuity and the interplay of the three times that enables us to understand anything at all, to experience anything at all. And that kind of, all of that here and there stuff, it's a pile of shit, you know. Because understanding, human understanding, is a kind of a backwards and forwards between the three times, you know. You know, I'm using language. It's a constant reference to the past. This use of language is a constant reference to the past. That past being those happy days, when my mother and other significant adults were teaching me to speak, or more accurately, when I was encouraging them to help me to learn to speak, but actually being sort of quite active in that process.
Yeah. That's what we were talking about the other day, wasn't it? The children actually Exactly that. Encourage the adults to teach them.
They're active in the learning process.
Yeah.
At least if we allow the hard wiring to kick in. You know, obviously, some schools historically have had the idea that a child's an empty vessel and you pour some shit in through a funnel in their ear or something, you know. Bad mistake.
Anyway.
Yeah, the three times. So this is the three times being completely enmeshed and woven together. I mean, similarly, all of our understanding, and certainly all of our philosophical thought and our contemplative thought, again, that the future is in there. We think about things in order to decide what to do. Or even if it's only to decide what to do or how to be in relation to some inevitability that's coming at us from the future. You know, the equiprimordiality of the three times is a technical term here.
And
Lao Tzu hit upon it, you know, again, like a good 2.5 centuries before Heidegger hit upon it in... and talked about it in his seminars to a bunch of Swiss psychiatrists in the 50s. Neither future nor past can exist alone. Well, obviously, you know, there is no past to accompany a future, because the future is an outgrowth of the past. There's no past. There's no soil for the outgrowth. Yeah. So again, mutual dependence, but in a very, very interesting sphere there, the whole kind of understanding of time. Funnily, the line before that seems to belong to like a different topic. It says, what you want and what you say should be the same. Okay, this is a recommendation for character, isn't it? You know, and Lao Tzu is very interested in human character. You know, he does see that there's a way of being a human being or a style of character that's preferable, that he recommends, and it's that of the sage. And you can see that the Lao Tzu is advice for a sage, or a would-be sage, you know, a wise person. And he envisages a wise person as somehow either the ruler of a state or the advisor to the kings or ministers that rule the state. He has this, again, ancient idea of the role of the wise person in government of society, in the arrangement of society.
It would make sense. It would be actually really, really nice if the wise people were in government.
Very much like Plato in the Republic. Lao Tzu is concerned with, you know, how should life be lived? And he says, well, like a sage, if you can. Yeah?
Yeah.
And how should the society be organised? Well, it should be... It should come under the benevolent rule of a sage. Plato's philosophy of kings, you know.
Which is completely the opposite to what we've got now.
Yeah, yeah. Not I'd want to live in the Republic, particularly. It's a nightmare. Plato probably shows us the shortcomings of philosopher kings, you know. But Lao Tzu is dealing with the same question, you know, how should life be lived, you know, and therefore how should society be organised, and into that he has to kind of deal with a whole collection of subsidiary questions, you know, such as the nature of language, the nature of time, the ultimate metaphysical structure of existence, the origin of existence, the nature of morality, and all these things, of course, which is what Plato does in the Republic. It's very similar terrain, yeah, but coming in a different context. Again, in this notion of character that concerns Lao Tzu, in the last verse of chapter 2, he says, the sage has no attachment to anything, and therefore does what is right without speaking by simply being in the Tao. So again, this is a question of character, and the character of the sage, who is someone who will potentially rule either by advising or actually by ruling. So Lao Tzu is advising simplicity of character, and actually oneness with the Tao. And so he's asking us to sort of get behind the regular structuring of our understanding through language, which operates through contrasts and ultimately contrasts of opposites. He's asking us to be one with the Tao, and of course in the Tao, the opposites are no longer opposites, but mutually dependent forces in a dynamic universe. And he's asking the sage to be one with that. So he's saying the sage, in virtue of being a sage, will have a deeper understanding than somebody who's locked into the structures of language and the ordinary structures of our understanding. So he is asking for contemplation on the part of would-be rulers. And he's asking for that contemplation to go deep enough to actually contact the source of things, to be in with the source of things. And so he said, the sage does write without speaking. Again, he's like, he said, language is great, I'm using it. This is what he's saying. He says, but on the other hand, he who speaks does not know. The Tao which can be named is not the true Tao. So there's a willingness to use language, and of course he uses it tremendously skillfully, but at the same time there's a bit of a suspicion about it. Because it imposes these dualities on our thinking, and gets us kind of ping-ponging between opposites, where we need to understand that they're dancing together.
Yeah.
And you can't have one without the other.
Yeah.
And
he's trying to give us like the most balanced view.
He's pretty balanced. Yeah, he balance is a big thing with him again. The sage is balanced. Again, there's this idea of this is a good way to be human, and this should be balanced, but you do right without speaking, but by simply being in the Tao. So it's like you're getting it from the horse's mouth. And this again, it's the Tao is spontaneous. It spontaneously creates the 10,000 things. First of all, the two, the mother and the father, who can copulate and be fecund, therefore, and produce the 10,000 things that we live in. And he wants us to avail ourselves of that creative power of the Tao itself. So it's spontaneous, spontaneous. So the sage is kind of quite spontaneous, but in a very reliable way.
But grounded.
Yeah.
Not kind of swirling off.
No. It's not capricious. He hates caprice. I would say, but at the same time, he sees that we get our most accurate insights and our safest plans for the future come when we get our information from the horse's mouth, which he claims, I suppose indirectly, that we can come about through contemplation of the Tao to the extent that we become one with the Tao. And what does he put it? By simply being in the Tao. Now, in chapter 4, there's quite a lot more about the sage. In chapter 3, he's introduced the sage as somebody who can make wise decisions and perform wise actions in virtue of being simply in the Tao. And to some extent, free of some of the shackles that language, with its reliance on binary oppositions, can can place upon our understanding of things. And if the sage is going to be a ruler, he's going to make good decisions. He don't want to be advising his people to kind of to invade Russia in the winter with no without any overcoats.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, there's a great deal of trust and faith in the intuition of sagacious people who apprehended the Tao. So in chapter 4, he starts, if the sage refuses to be proud, then people won't compete for his attention.
Yeah.
If the sage does not buy treasures, then the people won't want to steal them. If the sage governs with vision, then his people will not go wrong. Which, of course, that last one is what I just said, you know.
Yeah.
There is a trust at this time, and in Taoism, and Lao Tzu is extolling the virtues of sagacity. But sagacity is... it comes about through the contemplation of the Tao, or of that which incorporates the opposites and which gives birth to the opposites, which is able to contain both nothingness and everythingness. So there's this amazing trust. The sage governs with vision, then his people will not go wrong. What do you mean by with vision? Well, able to see the whole, able to sit down quietly and out of that quietness to apprehend the whole, to see it as process, to see the yin and the yang dancing together, the male and the female, the Shiva and the Shakti dancing together, making love together, to produce all this, and to see that imminently in all the micro events of consciousness, and also transcendentally as being an explanation of the complete panning out of cosmic time, from the beginning of time to the end of time. So this is what he's extolling there. He's extolling trust in that. But it's also, you know, you get this idea of the character of the sage here again. Yeah, the sage refuses to be proud, so people won't compete for attention, and doesn't buy treasures, so the people, nobody will want to steal them. It's like this kind of a virtue of like modesty and simplicity. Even though the sage is the ruler, he mustn't pomp and circumstance won't cut it. It will actually cause problems, you know. Simplicity, humility. And in fact, you know, we have this again, you know, this notion of the ideal human character. He's quite restrained, you know. He says in his wisdom he restrains himself by not being greedy for food, not dominating the state, but keeping himself healthy and fit.
Mm.
You know? And this is Socrates again, you know. Socrates lived very, very simply. Didn't want for much. Was poor. Could have made a lot of money, but couldn't be bothered. enjoyed himself going around teasing everybody, you know.
Yeah.
And having philosophical conversations. And there's a similar idea here, you know. And particularly when it comes to ruling, the sage doesn't dominate the state. It's not done by sheer force. It's not done by pomp and circumstance, by symbolism, by lots of gold and lots of decoration and lots of fine raiments. It's done through simplicity and modesty. And it's almost like, on this tape, the ideal ruler, nobody did know anything about him, you know, just be quite kind of shadowy. I mean, I think in modern times we kind of get disturbed by things like that, you know. But certainly this virtue of a modest and restrained character, you know, it's kind of, you do say that it's attractive, Then, the sage always makes sure that the people don't know what he's done, you see, he says. So they never want to be in control, and they are never driven by ambition. I mean, it's a utopian vision, isn't it, of a near anarchic society, which nevertheless there are some wise people keeping their eye on stuff and giving things a little tweak now and then when necessary, but tenders a policy not to interfere too much. Things are going all right. Just let it tick over, you know. and then people will be happy and not kind of hyper excited and ready to start fighting each other over idiocies, you know. I mean, he even says it here in the next line. He says he keeps them, the people, in truth like this, acting invisibly. You see, if there is nothing to fight for, then there is nothing that can break the flow. So he's very, very much in favour of a simplicity that's kind of, in virtue of its simplicity, he's profoundly in touch with the deep processes of everything. And out of that vision comes the understanding that actually at some level everything's kind of okay. It's ticking over, and we could use that to organise human societies if we're clever enough and modest enough, and if we don't get carried away swanking and amassing treasure and getting carried away with the pleasures of dominance, which are very, very seductive. I mean, Nietzsche said he thought that the will to power, the ability to exert the will to power over another, was the greatest narcotic of all times. Yeah. That it's a drug, you know, and that the high is, for some people, incomparable. And he says that as a motive for the triumph of Christianity, which started out as a slave religion in the Roman Empire, the religion of the slaves, who, in pursuit of small doses of the will to power, i.e. the ability to condescend their social betters, inverted commas, which drove Christianity to become the governing force of the Roman Empire. And Lao Tzu saying, "Oh, watch out for that, you know."
Absolutely.
This is what he's saying, you know, by not dominating the state. And as he goes on further in the Tao Te Ching, explaining the character of the sage, is he somebody that just doesn't want to operate by just sheer direct dominance, you know. It's kind of quietly tweaking that goes on, you know, but from a place of vision and a place of insight, brought about by contemplation of the Tao. Now, I think in modern times we might have a problem with that. And as I was saying yesterday in another podcast, you know, I think we have to be very careful about drawing metaphysical conclusions from our epiphanies, you know, or our meditative ecstasies. I don't think our meditative ecstasies decide anything metaphysically. This is probably an unpopular view amongst meditators, but I do think that what Lao Tzu calls, you know, simply being in the Tao, does produce a clarity of mind and a problem-solving ability, you know, mainly because the clutter, you know, the clutter and the restraints of language, which Lao Tzu has pointed out to us, do encourage us very often to make decisions that produce suffering for ourselves and others.
Yeah.
And I think this is if we understand that, we can go along with Lao Tzu, I think, to some extent. Even though, again, I don't want to live in a society that's ruled by anonymous sages, you know. Who's that, like the Bilderberg group, you know? You know, or... I think for modern times we need some transparency. But we do definitely need some clarity of thought. Mm. Some clarity of thought and some vision that goes a bit deeper into the nature of things without being doctrinaire, without being dogmatic, without being some kind of religious take on things that's it's going to become like a motive for proselytisation and missionary activity. I don't think we want that either. And I don't think that's what Lao Tzu's talking about. You know, he loves this simplicity. Yeah. I mean, actually, Lao Tzu's ideal society is the city of pigs. This is Socrates' favourite society, you know, like a bucolic, simple, easeful, not technologically very sophisticated life, you know. And he says, you know, Socrates, he imagines, well, I imagine growing old, sitting on a bench in my garden, watching the grandchildren play, and having some nice food out the garden, some beans, some feta, and a little bit of wine and some nice olive oil to drizzle over it, and sit there in my dotage, just really, really joyfully enjoying the simplicity of it. So it's kind of like, you know, it's a life of prosperity and simplicity is his vision. And of course the young aristocrats who Socrates is talking to when he mentions the city of pigs in the Republic.
What, no relish?
They turn around and say, yeah, what, no relish, you know. And no doubt this is what Lao Tzu was up against. Here's Lao Tzu imagining this idyllic, simple, prosperous, hippie commune in the midst of the warring states. You know, this is a time of great turmoil in ancient China.
Yeah. That's an important thing to kind of realise, you know, the environment and the cultural conditions of which he was actually writing this in.
Yeah, yeah. At this time, Confucius was gaining in influence, and legend has it that Lao Tzu was like an older contemporary of Confucius. And Confucius was the opposite of Lao Tzu. He was a bloke that thought social organisation needed lots of very strict rules and rules of etiquette, ways of engaging with your elders, your superiors, your youngers, your siblings. There's a whole lot of rules about how the family should be organised, and a whole lot of rules about how the state should be organised, and what the duties of the emperor were, and all this kind of stuff. And Confucianism gave rise to the enormous Chinese bureaucracy, you know, with the exam papers that kill people. You know?
Yeah.
Confucius's solution was like bureaucracy, rules, laws, very strict customs, very strict etiquette. And Lao Tzu was all for sort of saying, well, let's just chill, man. Yeah. And Taoists traditionally would hurtle off into the mountains to have a simple life of contemplation, to get away from the over-formality of Confucian society. And of course, Confucius won that one, you know. Confucianism is still alive and kicking, you know, 2.5 millennia down the line. So you need to understand that a lot of Lao Tzu's like hippie layback, you know, well, the sage rules by doing nothing. And if he does anything, it's a bit on the quiet. We can trust the sage because he's kind of plugged into the mother of the universe, you know. It's rather than rules and regulations and fixed customs, it's spontaneity. It's openness to the inspiration. All the creativity associated with Taoism worships spontaneity, which is something which passed over into Zen, in Japanese Zen, the love of those spontaneous accidents in ceramics, for instance, or, you know, the admiration for the most free calligraphy, the admiration in martial arts for true spontaneity. Because these are very, very effective ways of doing stuff, but are completely at odds with the Confucian kind of anal retentive reliance on law and rules. Yeah. And this is an enormous theme. And Lao Tzu, all the way through this, when he's talking about social organisation, as well as character, he's actually, you know, he's got one eye on the Confucians, and he's having a little dig at them. And if you understand that, a lot of this makes sense. And some of the hyperbole of it, you know, you can then kind of moderate it a little bit. So for individuals living in the modern world with the internet and global warming and Donald Trump and I heard North Korea tested a missile this morning, you know, into the you know, in this kind of crazy modern world, this is what I'm trying to get at with these examples. Well, how does this figure, you know, nobody listening to this is going to be in a position of the sage who governs or anything like that. What's this about? But I think there is words of wisdom for modern individuals, particularly those modern individuals who do turn to meditation, because this is a natural thing for human beings to do. We've always done it. We've always wanted to kind of go in, some of us, and find out what's going on. And I think Lao Tzu gives us loads and loads of hints and tips, you know, about all that. He's a great pointer. At the same time, he's warning us off against turning any of it into dogma with his repeated warnings about carried away by language. It's not against language. You'd be wrong to say he was against language. Otherwise, he wouldn't have written the thing at all. But at the same time, he gives us some warnings about getting captured. Captured in binary concepts and captured it by Confucian laws, regulations, and thy consciousness. You know, Confucianism operates almost entirely on thy consciousness. It's all about what people think. Lao Tzu is saying, well, fuck it. You know, if you're a meditator, yeah, don't worry about that shit.
Yeah.
Go quiet. Go simple. And look, and it's there, right in front of your eyes, if you want it to be. If you just, I almost said brave enough, really.
Okay, well, thank you for listening, everybody. I hope that was useful.
And we'll speak to you soon.